And I think we'll end up in the north like they are in the south, but much worse. We'll have famines, we'll have wastelands, we'll have epidemics, and we'll have social disintegration. Or we could switch the military spending for development in developing countries, which I think would decrease the social instability in these countries, which poverty causes, and would also thereby decrease the East-West, the imported East-West conflicts. If you look at the troubled areas of the world, in most of these troubled areas, there's massive poverty. You'll see the Soviet Union or the Americans behind one or the other side, be it Central America or Ethiopia or Angola. And maybe one day that could escalate. So it's in our interests in the north to create a more stable peace and development in the south as well. I'll leave that topic just for now. I think that's enough. I'll just briefly talk about family violence and human rights, and then I'll go on to some perhaps solutions. In our emergency wards, we see when children come in with injuries, 10%, one in every 10 child that comes in with an injury in our emergency ward, it's because of physical abuse by parents or adults. One in 10. And as a report I read a year or two ago in the Toronto Globe and Mail suggested that 25% of Canadian women are regularly beaten by their husbands. 25%. So what? There's a lot of family stress out there. I had the opportunity to be a general practitioner in a mining town and in a farming town and in a fishing village and dealing with a lot of the rural poor. And it seems to me the factors of unemployment, which is a big problem in developing countries as well, alcohol and drug abuse, and decreased social services. And it's interesting, in the United States, a lot of social programs are being cut back, and I'm sure the same is true for the Soviet Union, because money is going into the defense budget. And you wonder, while spending all this money to meet an external threat, are you missing the fact of your own internal security is going to get you if the family units blow apart on you and all the problems that we know that causes. With regards to human rights, Baha'is are probably better versed than anybody, than not anybody, but most people on torture with our friends from Iran. Suffice it to say that in 117 of the 150 sovereign states in the world, there's been reports of political prisoners who've been killed, tortured, or subjected to degrading treatment. And in 1984, 27 African, 16 Asian, and 15 Latin American states were noted by Amnesty International to make systemic use, in other words, condone policy, government policy, of cruel and degrading treatment to oppress political dissidents and persecute religious and ethnic minorities. It's a big problem. In the Universal House of Justice's book, I'm sure many of you have read it, on the Baha'i Statement of Peace, edited by Hussein Danish, they talked about barriers to peace. And I'll just quickly run through these. Racism, number one was racism, and that goes against the Baha'u'llah's prescription of the oneness of mankind. Barriers to development in the third world or developing countries, we talked about excessive military spending. And it's interesting that defense in these countries outweighs the health and education spending, and the fact that half of developing countries are controlled by military governments. The huge debt load in countries, these poor countries, a lot of them with fragile democracies, have the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, have imposed severe austerity measures which threatens the fragile democracies of these countries. The population explosion, which, as I said, I believe is secondary to the crushing poverty. The ecological disasters with deforestation and desertification, and the various and multiple civil wars and regional conflicts going on. When I was working in Ethiopia, in Sudan rather, looking after the Ethiopians, they were from the rebel province of Tigray, and they've hence gone back. I'll be showing just a few slides, but How do you get water projects going or immunization projects going when the jet fighters come out on sunny days to bomb the wells and bomb the villages? How do you get agricultural programs going on? And the UN, at their recent conference, have recognized this problem and resolved as best as they can to try to help resolve some of these conflicts. It's a major impedance to development and peace. The idea of a lot of developing countries growing cash crops for foreign currency, such as cotton, when using up the land which otherwise could be taken for food crops to feed their own people. And it's not a criticism, because a complete criticism, because you do need some foreign currency to get ahead in this world. It's a problem of how to achieve a balance. And the overemphasis on the Western developmental approach, the industrial approach versus the agricultural approach in many of these developing countries, spending millions and millions on huge industrial complexes that shut down a year or two later because of lack of managerial capacity or lack of maintenance funds. And unbridled nationalism were some of the other barriers to peace mentioned in the Universal House of Justice's book. Unbridled nationalism, which leads to competition and wars, which sort of contradicts Baha'u'llah's statement that the earth is but one country and mankind its citizens. Opposite ends of the poles. The religious strife, problems with the emancipation of women, ignorance through lack of education, which breeds prejudice and mistrust and is often fueled by state propaganda on both sides in terms of East and West, and lack of a global language. I'll take a second here before I get into some prescriptions for peace, hopefully, to tell a little story. I had a very close friend who I've done general practice with in Nova Scotia, who, when he finished medical school, went to Nepal for 6 months. And this will just give you an idea of some language difficulties. The first day he was in Kathmandu, the capital of Nepal, and he was in a pediatric hospital doing ward rounds with an Australian pediatrician. And she would greet each of her patients each morning with the phrase, Yak Mahuda, Yak Mahuda. And my friend Don said, fine, this is the Nepalese way to say, how are you, greetings. So he would walk down the hospital hall and go, Yak Mahuda. And he'd go out into the village markets and he'd say to the vendors, Yak Mahuda. And he thought, well, the people aren't too friendly here. I wonder what's wrong. And the next day, one of his colleagues stopped him in the hall. And when he heard him saying this, Yak Mahuda, he said, do you know what you're saying to these people? And he said, yes, good morning, greetings. He said, no, you're saying, did your bowels move this morning? So it's a problem, as you can see. A couple little points before I show a few slides, and then I'll conclude there with perhaps some of the ways that we can tackle the problems, and hopefully just to give food for thought for this afternoon's seminars. I guess the guiding principle that I think is going to get us out of this mess in the next 20 years is that principle of the oneness of mankind. The deterrence theory of mutual assured destruction is not going to get us anywhere but destroyed, I'm sure. And treaties might have a practical value, but they won't hold up, I don't think, without this positive force, this positive will to unite. It's oneness of mankind. One of the things that we need is just understanding. There's a great need for it. The Soviet Union and the United States have started to embark and have had for a while cultural and scientific and sport exchanges. And that helps to dispel and decrease the mistrust of the American people in their light of the Soviets and vice versa. It's much harder to bomb somebody that you know than somebody that you don't know and just see as the unknown enemy. And believe me, both sides, both governments, are fueling, I think, this mistrust with some of their propaganda. Both are equally to blame for this. And that's why, hopefully, it's up to the everyday person to find out what the everyday person is like over there. They don't want war any more than we do. They just want to get on with the business of living and family raising and growing old peacefully. You can be sure of it. The other thing, I think, when it comes to understanding is to realize that getting rid of nuclear weapons alone isn't going to bring peace or prevent war. There's lots of ways to kill people. It's important to get rid of nuclear, it's important to control the arms race, because if we don't do that, we'll destroy ourselves. But just by doing that, that's only the first step. Just like giving food aid to hungry people won't address the causes of famine either. You have to address the root causes. And it comes on, these causes, both the things that are powering hunger and powering the arms race, both come down to man's inhumanity to man. And once again, we have to get back to that principle of the oneness of mankind. Also, I think it's important when we're having these discussions and when you're thinking about development, you have to be careful. We all have our good intentions, but you can sometimes do more harm than good unless you consult the people whose lives you're going to affect. For example, we talked about the schistosomiasis example with building irrigation ditches to help agriculture, to help food, but then the snails come in and you get schistosomiasis. You have to think ahead about these things. Also, if you were to go into an African country and all of a sudden build wells, often what happens, especially when there's nomadic people around, their herds increase because there's water. The herds increase and then they overgraze. Then you get desertification, and there's no land to support either the herds or crops. So that's a problem. You have to think about how to still clean water for everybody. Also, food aid. If you give food aid to people in some countries, often what will happen is that you will drive down the price of the local foods that the local farmers grow, and you'll put them out of business. And then what you've created is a long-term dependency, haven't you? Because the farmers are no longer there to even give food for their own people. So you have to think about rational, considered ways to give food aid when it's needed and how not to hurt the local farmers. Also, the problem of how principled, we talk about the oneness of mankind. How far should we go with this principle in a world such as ours, sort of the hard, cold world out there? And how pragmatic should we be? For example, should we give aid to repressive governments? Or should we of poor countries? Or should we withhold that on their human rights performances? How fair is that to the people? Or should we give aid to poor countries who are at war? Some people say by giving aid, it takes the burden off the government so they can spend more money on arms. And these are things that we have to talk about. There's a problem now. There's an organization which you may have heard of called the International Physicians for Prevention of Nuclear War, which are headed by an American and a Soviet cardiologist. And one of the things that's threatening to divide this organization is the fact that some people in the organization think that to be consistent on a principle level, that you should criticize the Soviet Union for its human rights violations. Another says, look, if you do that, you're going to blow apart the organization and we won't have anything, any form of dialogue. And that's a problem. What is right there? How pragmatic should you be, or how principled should you be? Education is one of the crucial aspects of the solution. I remember my very first patient when I was in the refugee camp. A little boy, Tesfaye Arage, 8 years old, beautiful little boy, came in unconscious with malaria. Very, very sick. We put an intravenous line in to give him some salt and water. And I asked one of the health workers, the hospital workers, because we used the local Ethiopians to run all the clinics. I said, please give this boy an injection in the muscle of some chloroquine. And I went around and saw some other patients, and I came back and I went over to re-examine the child, and he died in my arms right away, my first patient. After here, you know, a year of tropical medicine, going to go in and no problems, malaria, we'll get him fixed up. And what had happened is this my hospital worker had given the injection through the intravenous and not in the muscle. So even though I'd thought about this before I came to the camp, I said, right, the way to go about this is not to say, I'll tell you what to do. It's, I'll teach you what to do from that point on. There's no point in me doing everything there, because when I leave, if I do everything, they're not going to know how to do anything. So right at that point, it drove home the fact of teaching, leaving something behind, imparting skills. The Albert Schweitzer idea of doctoring is over with. Also, education to overcome illiteracy. One big problem in developing countries, for example, to run an immunization program, you need skilled managers and technicians and administrators. And there's very few of these. This is well recognized to be a big problem. So education is crucial for development. Maybe a third prescription for peace is the Baha'i ideal of consultation. And Baha'u'llah said, consultation is the shining light which in a dark world leads the way and guides. The gift of understanding is made manifest through consultation, both within ourselves and with people whose lives we hope to better. I have one interesting story is with regard to schistosomiasis. Some Western aid experts went into a country in Africa and into a little village, and they were going to make this a model. These women and children were playing and washing in the river, full of snails, full of worms. They were all getting sick with schistosomiasis. So they said, right, we're going to build a water pump and clean the water, and every little grass hut is going to have its own tap. Great. So they did it. Spent a lot of money and they did it, and went away feeling very good. And they came back a year later, only to find all the women and the children back in the river, washing and playing. What they failed to do was consult with the people, the women and children. That was a social gathering. They didn't want to be behind their own tukuls in the grass huts in the morning. They wanted to be together, just like we like to be together with our friends over coffee. So then what they did is that they built a communal washing place and place where the kids could have a bath, and it worked. Simple things, good intentions, but not consulting the people or asking them what would be appropriate for them. And there's been a lot of money wasted on such projects because we thought we had all the right ideas and we could apply the Western idea of doing things in developing countries. And then after consultation, what's required from all of us and how do we reconcile our affluence with people's poverty in the South? And I don't think it really matters to what extent you do things in helping other people. It's just that it has to be a lifelong commitment. The idea of live aid, for example, it will only be a short experience of easing our guilty conscience, if we don't go on and make a lifelong commitment to what, however much we're capable of. As health workers, we can do several things. The one is advising governments. Advising them of the futility of preparing for nuclear war and thinking that we could survive it and that a limited war might be winnable. Advising them of the ill effects of unemployment. The ill effects of huge defense budgets, which, as we talked about, starve social programs, which could otherwise educate young minds and help troubled families. And this idea of internal peace and security in your own country. If you don't look after that, it doesn't matter who your outside enemies are, you'll destroy yourself. Also, increasing official aid, correcting this imbalance between military and official spending. The United Nations has recommended that each country in the West spend 0.7% of its gross annual growth national product. I think only a few Scandinavian countries even come close to this, and Canada only spends about half of that. So are there ways that we as health workers can advise our local MPs of this discrepancy? Also for famine, realizing that famine isn't caused by drought. Someone described famine once as the photogenic end on a long road of disaster. It's caused by poor people. there is drought going on right now in Australia and in the southeastern United States, and you don't see people starving there. You don't see people starving there. Famine, I believe it's man-made. Right now, my friends, I've got